Health and Fitness with David Hollywood, with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club, MidlandsParkHotel.com.
Midlands 103.
Hello, and welcome to this week's programme. Let's have a look at what there is to look forward to. We all know that it's important to remain engaged as we age. Brain training, games, physical activity and so on. What about creativity? What does art do for us when we become older people? We'll look to answer that for you very shortly indeed. Just how much does the menstrual cycle affect women playing sport? How well resourced and educated are women's coaches in sport when it comes to the menstrual cycle? We have a lead researcher from the She Research Group in Tooth Athlone with us to tell you about a new study on this important issue. You'll learn about hypochondria, or illness anxiety disorder, with our resident medical expert Dr. Deirdre Ford from Cala Medical in Westmeath, and we have someone from the Blizzards to talk about rugby, golf and the after-dinner circuit. On Health and Fitness, we have often highlighted the benefits of being active into older age, but something that we haven't spent enough time on is the benefits that we can get through aging from being creative. But there's plenty of work and evidence, and those fully committed to the cause to suggest that there is real traction to be made for our health and our personal an emotional wealth, I suppose, to look at this question. I'm very glad to say that the founder of Creative Aging International, Dominic Campbell, joins us on Health and Fitness this evening. Dominic, thanks so much for taking our call.
Great to be here.
So talk to me about Creative Aging International. Where did the initiative and the program come from initially?
So it really grew out of the amazing Bealtaine Festival. So Bealtaine Festival is an initiative of age and opportunity. It takes place, obviously, as the name says, across the month of May. And back in the, 10 years ago or something, that was one of the things that I led, that I worked on. It's an amazing thing for people who are not aware of it, because all across the country, there is a celebration of creativity as people age, and it takes place in hospitals, and it takes place in art centres, and it takes place in public centres, and it does all sorts of fantastic things about making older people visible, making the issues and concerns of older people visible, and connecting institutions and organizations. And so Creative Aging International grew from that learning, because one of the things that we realized was we would be bringing people in, or people would approach us from Australia and the US and Singapore and say, we really like that. How do we do it where we live? And so Creative Aging International really started from there. It started from looking at the US at, you know, what happens when people get older. Is it contextually different? What learning can we take from Ireland to other places? And it's developed from then, really. So that's kind of where we started.
Okay. Now, when it comes to art and participation in creative spheres for older people, there's one obvious thing that occurs to me as we speak today, and that is one of the big issues. And we've spoken to the charities like Alone about how people can fall into isolation as they age. Being part of a creative group, taking part in a creative process, that must serve to counteract that.
Yeah, one of the things that about arts is what they call in the medical world, they call it psychosocial benefit. So it's partly to do with your psychology, with your brain. It's partly to do with your sociability. And I never get those words right. But it's to do with being connected. And you can see it in people that are active in sports groups. You know, it's what you see. It's the fun of going and doing something with other people. And in Ireland, there are lots and lots of groups, but you might not think about them as doing that. So knitting groups, stitching groups, you know, art making groups, anything that's kind of collective. And obviously, as your geography shrinks, as your legs are maybe not what they once were, or you run out of puff a little bit quicker, then having something that's nearby and local becomes incredibly important. And if you're part of that, in your 30s and your 40s and your 50s, it's kind of easy. But if you're in your 60s and 70s, if you move house, you downsize or you move to a different part of the country, if the people around you that you connect with, and there are less of them, then it just gets more difficult to make that first step. And so what we know is those arts groups are really welcoming, they're really useful, and they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So there's quite often something that fits everybody. And over the last decade, particularly, we've seen this become much more organized, I guess. So, on the one hand, all those cultural creative art centers are beginning to really make efforts to reach out to people, to organize things at times of day that are helpful, or to come to groups, or to build bridges. And then on the other hand, organizations or people like GPs are now beginning to run things like social prescription programs, because for a GP, 20 to 30% of the people that go to a GP don't necessarily have a medical issue. They don't have a,
Okay.
biomedical issue. They need connection, they need social help. And so around the country, there's a growing social prescription movement where what they call link workers help people identify, fun activities, interesting stuff to do that's nearby to them. An amazing movement.
Yeah, that sounds really progressive. It's great to hear that, that kind of work is going on. So we've established that creative art groups, for instance, can bring older people out of isolation. But it's not simply a case of putting someone in a group and then they chat to the person to the left of them and to the right of them, and that they feel great. There's another element to this, which is the creative process, investing their own creative expression into something and having that recognized. And you mentioned, I think, earlier the idea of being seen as an older person. To be someone who has created something that other people can experience, by definition, adds another really important dynamic there.
Yeah, this psychological side of it, I guess, in some ways. So there was this beautiful study in Washington University a long time ago now, probably about 10 years ago, by a guy called Gene Cohen. And Gene Cohen said, art is like chocolate for the brain. And what he meant was it activates all the pleasure senses. It
Okay.
activates all sorts of the parts of the brain at once. So when you are making a painting, when you are doing something that's not necessarily verbal, even or even when you're doing something that's using words but moving them around in ways that are not usual, like poetry, what you're doing is making different patterns in your brain. And that, the color pink and the color red and the color blue, when you mix them together on a piece of paper, for you, they've got an emotional investment at some level. It means something to you. And by reorganizing and removing them around, what you're doing is moving around the way that your neurons connect together, your brain patterns work. So that spills out. It spills out from what you do with a pen, or what you do with words, or what you do with a paintbrush. It spills out into kind of more daily life. So the making of art, even if you're just working on it on a, even if you're stuck at home or stuck in bed, if you've got a piece of paper and a pen, you've got meaning, value, and purpose in that page. You can make a little world in front of you, and you can play with that little world, and you can experiment with it. And what you're doing while you're playing with the pen and the paper is you're also experimenting neurologically with how you make how, where you fit in the world. So it's meaning, value, and purpose. So there are two things going on. There's the connection with other people, but there's also a kind of connection with yourself. And that's so important, particularly at those stages in your life when there's a shift. When you it's really great for teenagers, but it's equally great for people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s now, who are becoming something else. They're entering a new phase of their life. It's helping people ask those questions, the big questions, which the arts, when it's really good, that's what it does. It helps you ask those big questions about who am I in the world and who am I now. And we used to think that was stuff that only happened in the theaters with the red drapes and the nice carpet, but actually it's a tool that you can use yourself in whatever way suits you, and you can keep using that. We know from all the work that we've been doing over the last 20, 30 years, it's something that anybody, whatever level of health you're at, can find and flourish in, providing maybe you need a little bit of help and encouragement just to get started.
Dominic, your enthusiasm and care for this particular area comes across very clearly. What is it about what you're doing at the moment? Because I know you've a huge background in the arts from, management and creativity and all of this. But in recent times, you've obviously been focusing some or all of your energy on bringing art into the community in this particular way. Talk to me about your personal experience doing this.
Yeah, I'm now 58, going on 59, and so now a whole pile of things that felt like a misspent youth start to make sense. So at one point I was the artistic director of St. Patrick's Festival, and I organised the big floats and the fireworks displays. And even within that, I was still commissioning artists to work with kids from difficult air codes, who could walk down the street dressed as a king or a queen and feel like they belong and they owned the city. So that sense of what the creative practice, whatever it is, helps you to do, helps you to become. I was always interested in transformation, and that everybody got a chance to be on stage, if you will, to have the spotlight shone on them, to be visible. And you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And that's, when you're a kid, that's usually important. But it's also really important if, you know, people tell me in the 70s and 80s that, you know, they walk down the street and they feel invisible. And so to put the spotlight on people and to understand their story and what's happening to them and who they were and who they are becoming, that's just fantastic, because it allows people that are younger than that to direct themselves. You know, I could be that, I can become that, or I need to be careful of not being that. So the good and the bad. So at the moment, a lot of what we're doing is we are working in three ways, I suppose. One way is internationally. So we are, you know, this morning I was on the Zoom calls with people in Brisbane and people in Botswana and people in India who are looking to take ideas that they're learning from Ireland and adapt to their own places. And also we're looking at bringing things back. Quite a lot of that is around creativity and neuroscience and Creative Brain Week, and Trinity is a big part of that. And then we're also looking at end of life. So with the Irish Hospice Foundation, we've been working over the last 3 years to make a creative program with them. And sometimes that's with people who run hospitals or residential care homes. And sometimes it's with community groups, and sometimes it's with people who are grieving or bereft. And sometimes it's with people who have a terminal diagnosis or are end of life. So if you're interested in that work, hospicefoundation.ie, have a look at their work.
Fantastic.
It's an amazing program and really rich and rewarding.
It's really a case of, from your own personal perspective, Dominic, it sounds like it's food for your soul, the work that you do.
I'm really lucky. I'm myself, B. Keller, that's the co-founder of Creative Aging International. We recognize that, you know, on a good day, things are fantastic. And we work with people who are in challenging, changing circumstances. But, you know, the great thing about creativity is we made the world, we made the healthcare systems, we made the lives we lead to some extent, and we can remake them almost at any stage. There are options on how you can remake, how you can reimagine what you might be, and with a bit of support, become it.
Well, we're very lucky to have people like you in the position that you've taken up doing the work that you do. We really thank you for joining us on Health and Fitness this evening. Dominic Campbell, founder of Creative Aging International. Thanks again for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Dominic, always an interesting listen. I hope you enjoyed that chat. Ignorance and neglect. Two words you could use to describe how women's place in sport has been treated. Not so much anymore. We'll be talking to a woman who's in the vanguard of change next.
Health and fitness with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. With fitness classes to suit everyone, experience the warmth at 30 degrees in our dedicated spin studio. Discover all this and more on MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. Next on Health and Fitness, we're covering a topic that we've featured frequently over the last number of months, and it's in relation to the impact of the menstrual cycle on female athletic performance. A study conducted by Toos Athlone in partnership with Offaly Sports Partnership has revealed a significant gap in coaches' understanding of how the cycle works and affects women over the course of an athletic career, or obviously to any degree. The headline takeaway here is that coaches, they need resources to better support athletes' menstrual health. I'm very glad to say that joining us on the programme this evening is Niamh Fogarty, a PhD candidate in the SHE research group at TUS Athlone, and has been working as the lead on this study. Niamh, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for having me on. Fantastic opportunity to be able to promote the great work of SHE Research and to be able to share the findings of my first study.
Let's talk about the findings of this study and the work that the research group is doing. Talk to us about what the objectives of the study were and what you found to be the most telling takeaways.
Yeah, so this time last year, we carried out a study on the menstrual cycle and interviewed Irish coaches on their experiences working with female athletes. And yeah, what we were trying to achieve with this was to try and understand how coaches in Ireland are currently supporting female athletes around the menstrual cycle, or trying to. We wanted to try and identify the factors, so like the barriers and facilitators. So how coaches are supporting female athletes, and what helps them to support them, but also what hinders that support provision. At the same time, we wanted to try and identify if there were any areas in particular that coaches felt they needed support around the menstrual cycle. So yeah, this time last year, we interviewed 16 coaches, nine male coaches and seven female coaches. And they came from various sporting backgrounds, coaching athletes across different sporting levels, so right from participation level to performance. And that was key for the project because it meant that we got a much broader view of what was happening nationally. And as a result, we were able to collect some very interesting findings.
I mean, I'm browsing over some of the takeaways that the study has produced. And I appreciate that there's an awareness that there is a level of ignorance, if that's not a contradiction in terms, but some of the things here are still quite surprising that, you know, for instance, there's a real misunderstanding among coaches about what the menstrual cycle is and how it works, even among female coaches who have may have been through this process and experience themselves personally. But by the same token, it shows that so many people in this country, for instance, are coming from a place of ignorance because we'd been underinformed and the topic had been under-researched in the past.
Yeah, and I think that is key, the point you make there. Like, even though most females would have lived experience of the menstrual cycle, it doesn't necessarily give them the knowledge or experience to be able to provide support to athletes, and that's key. As you mentioned there, yeah, there is a mixed understanding amongst coaches about what the menstrual cycle actually is. Many kind of misidentify it as just the period itself, but there's a lot more that goes on throughout the course of a menstrual cycle. So although coaches mightn't have a clear understanding of the physiology, they do understand that it's important and it's a factor that should be considered, particularly if there are female athletes who are negatively impacted. So that's positive. But yeah, regarding performance, the opinions around the menstrual cycle were very mixed as well. Coaches weren't sure whether or not it did impact or didn't impact performance. But again, that was influenced by their own personal experiences and their own knowledge. So yeah, I think it's just about creating a greater understanding amongst coaches and improving their knowledge and awareness around it, because ultimately the menstrual cycle is very unique, a very individual experience. So yeah, understanding how female athletes are impacted on an individual scale is really important for the support that they receive.
It's an interesting challenge that you've outlined there, that everyone going through the menstrual cycle has their unique and personal biological experience with it. But when it comes to sports and best practice in coaching, there's a work to create a universal best practice approach, I suppose. How far away are we, do you think, based on the work that you've done and the interviews that you conducted, from coaches universally being able to apply the right methodology? Because, as you say, the physical impacts of the menstrual cycle, they can be quite telling, and I imagine a very a very nuanced approach to coaching is needed in this area.
Absolutely. And to be honest, it's a difficult one to know, because at the moment there are no evidence-based guidelines for coaches to follow in terms of tailoring training around the menstrual cycle. And the research does recommend taking an individual approach. And that is something that coaches highlighted in the study. But at the same time, it was very positive to hear that coaches recognize that it's important to consider. So although some coaches try to educate their female athletes around the menstrual cycle, and others mentioned that they would have tried to provide sanitary products, there's still kind of uncertainty around how coaches should be supporting athletes. But they acknowledge that it's something they should consider. I think particularly at performance level, coaches were very focused on, of course, trying to achieve performance and to talk around menstrual cycle monitoring. But again, they felt that there wasn't much kind of research or guidelines on how to do this. There is some great research coming out recently on how coaches might implement menstrual cycle monitoring, but it is important to recognize that it's not as straightforward as it seems. There's a lot of knowledge and understanding needed in order to implement these kind of practices.
The question of female participation in sport is one that's getting a good degree of platforming and mileage in recent years, and this plays into it as well, that how we handle and how coaches handle the question of the menstrual cycle for young women, I imagine, has a big impact on if someone through their teenage years is experiencing their period for the first time. Like, we observe that there's a lot of dropout in young women in sport around that period of time. I'm guessing and reading between the lines, must be a part of the picture.
Absolutely. That is something that coaches acknowledged, particularly those who were working with participation or youth level athletes. So they recognize that, you know, the menstrual cycle can have some additional challenges for youth athletes who are going through puberty, like you said, and they're trying to understand their body and the changes going on. So the supports that they receive might be a little bit different. That is something that we found in the study, that the supports that performance level athletes received versus participation were slightly different. At participation level, coaches were very cognizant of the fact that some youth athletes might feel comfortable speaking to a coach about the menstrual cycle, particularly if the coach is male. There is this idea that, you know, male coaches mightn't feel as comfortable speaking to athletes and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So they made efforts to try and create comfortable environments for female athletes to feel safe enough to openly talk to them about their menstrual cycle. And often this meant outsourcing other females within the environment. So maybe like a female liaison officer and dedicating them with the role of offering support rather than making the athletes come directly to the coach. So that's one thing. And parents as well were also used as a source of support to try and help youth female athletes around the menstrual cycle.
Yeah, it sounds like if this stigma can be overcome between coaches and athletes, great progress can be made. We were speaking to someone from the Tullamore Harriers recently who trains young women, and said what they do is if a young woman turns up for training and she's going through her period, or she's experiencing physical symptoms of her menstrual cycle, she'll give her coach the thumb up, and the coach will then know that they can maybe tailor a lighter session for them without it being an overt communication, as it were. But very quickly after trialing this, the girls really lean into and embrace the thumbs up, and they all know what it means. And when you lift that stigma and that pressure, the relief and the release is a really positive one.
Yeah, and you know, it's great that they can find their own ways to communicate. A thumbs up is a good start. Hopefully we'll get to a stage where these young girls will feel comfortable enough to actually openly talk about it. But yeah, no, it's a great start, and being able to talk about these things hopefully will become a little bit easier in the future. Once coaches have a good understanding of how their female athletes are impacted, then hopefully that should make it a little bit easier then when it comes to them trying to offer support and guidance.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of the road to travel, it sounds like, in this respect. Just to finish up, Niamh, that cast forward, what work needs to be done where as a priority at the moment in this field?
Well, I think one of the main things and something that we find is that the focus should be on developing simple and accessible educational resources for coaches. Coaches highlighted that there is a challenge in trying to locate and understand and implement research. And I think that's important for us as researchers to acknowledge that, you know, not every coach is going to have a background in academia and research, and some may not know how to find or critically analyze research papers the way we do. So it's really important that when we're disseminating our research and our findings, that we produce simple, accessible resources that they can take, that have key take-home points that will hopefully make it a little bit easier for them to implement these findings into practice. And She Research have done a great job in that so far. They have some female athlete educational infographics, which you can download for free on their website. And they cover a lot of topics across the menstrual cycle, including things like communication and how to use period products and things like that. So, that's just one example of keeping things simple and accessible for coaches.
Yeah, if you want to take in the full study, it's available at sheresearch.ie. That's the website Niamh just mentioned. Niamh Fogarty from Tusath Alone. Congratulations on this particular piece of work. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us on the programme, and the very best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you. And just before I go, I would like to just finally say a word of thanks to all of the coaches who took part in the study. Obviously, a special word of thanks to Offaly Sports Partnership for their collaboration in this project, and for Sports Ireland for their funding. Of course, the ongoing support from She Research into US is greatly appreciated, and I can't forget the fantastic research team behind this project too. So Dr. Niamh Kelleher, Dr. Kieran O'Cohan, and Dr. Aoife Lane, thank you very much for your support.
Well done, one and all. Yeah, huge work being done in the Midlands and in Tusath alone with the She Research Group. Next, hopefully you'll learn something new about hypochondria.
Health and fitness with the all-new Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club, where relaxation meets rejuvenation. Find out more at midlandsparkhotel.com. Midlands 103.
In Ireland, we're a great country for ultimately, I suppose, suppressing some of the difficulties we go through. So there's going to be people with probably strong feelings on the idea of hypochondria, maybe providing complaints about something that might not necessarily justify it. But the place where hypochondria becomes most telling and pronounced and ultimately most important is in the doctor's office, be it your GP or in a hospital. I'm very glad to say that Deirdre Ford from Cata Medical in Athlone, Health and Fitness's resident GP, joins us to look at this issue. Deirdre, hypochondria as it is and as it presents, must present doctors across the region and all across the world with a particularly tricky balancing act.
It certainly does, David, because I suppose when you've got somebody who suffers from hypochondriasis, you know, a patient who is a hypochondriac, they are in the doctor's surgery day in, day out, with illnesses that they believe to be real, when in fact, despite investigations, there's absolutely nothing wrong. And a lot of the fear that they have is that they have a cancer. So if they present with a headache, they're convinced they've got a brain tumor, or if they've got a pain in their tummy, they have cancer. And no amount of convincing them with showing them, you know, detailed investigations and explaining the reports that you know, this is not the case. And apparently when somebody goes to seek help, you know, with maybe a psychiatrist or a psychologist around their issues of hypochondriasis, the last thing apparently that you say to a patient is, it's all in your head, or the last thing they want to hear is stuff like that.
Mm.
So you've got to really, really try and play it out and see where is all this coming from, because there's usually a history somewhere. There may be, it may well be that a parent was always sort of suffering from an anxiety disorder, or was obsessed with their own health, or they had obsessive compulsive disorder tendencies. But the other thing too is that somebody who suffered any kind of trauma, so we're talking about maybe kids who saw parents who were divorced, the anxiety, this is all anxiety related, if for want of a better word, it's anxiety related. You know, if there was parents who were divorced, or if there was a parent that was away for a long, long time, say a mum was working away for 4 months of time, or dad was working away, in children under the age of 18, that produces an awful lot of anxiety. Now, hypochondriasis, or the hypochondriac patient now, this has now been reworded as presenting with an illness anxiety disorder. That's what hypochondriasis is now, mm-hmm. illness anxiety disorder. And it's actually where somebody believes that they are ill when they're not ill.
It also goes to show that the term hypochondria is a very loaded one now. So it's not something that I imagine medical practitioners can wheel out without yeah. having maybe a negative effect on a patient, or certainly maybe exposing the doctor to a level of scrutiny or criticism. But what's in a name like hypochondria? Why are we calling it that, do you know?
Why are we calling it that? So very interesting, because when I was thinking about this today, I said, well, you know, when you're a GP or a doctor, whatever you're training, and you're examining the abdomen, there are four segments in the abdomen that we examine. One is the right hypochondrium, the left hypochondrium. So the right hypochondrium is under the breastbone. It's where your gallbladder and your liver is. Left side, left hypochondrium is where your spleen is. And then down to the right-hand side, it's called the right iliac fossa, where your appendix is. And then the left iliac fossa, where your bowel is. So they're the four areas that we generally examine. But apparently, and very interesting, that the word hypochondriac has to come from hypochondrium, which basically means that in the back in the 16th century, they said that the upper abdomen turned out to be the seat of melancholy at a time when the now outdated medical theory of the four humours, which are blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile, this was accepted as a basis for legitimate health practice. But then in the 17th century, they discovered that hypochondriac referred to people who suffer from depression and melancholy without cause. And that's where the name comes from. So a lot of these depressed, unhappy people complained of abdominal pain.
Okay.
That's where it comes from. And very interesting.
And it brings us back to the idea of anxiety, which is maybe still the main driver. A recent Swedish study, I think they worked with 42,000 people over a 20-year period. And that study suggests that people who worry excessively about their health tend to die earlier than those who don't. They found that worriers died 5 years younger than those who worried less. And obviously, it is a great and cruel irony there that someone who is so health focused and conscious is counting against themselves in that respect. What's going on, do you think, that's causing the lifespan to contract when we're going through these anxieties?
Okay, I think what's happening then, anyone who suffers from chronic anxiety, so these the people who have illness, anxiety disorder, their cortisol levels now are going to start increasing. So cortisol in itself is going to start producing negative effects on your body. Your immune system is going to start being compromised by it. But a lot of these people then, you know, they may die from natural causes, but they will be found to have maybe, because they worry so much that their blood pressure now is going up and their cardiovascular system is being compromised by all of this. So it's complete. It's a complete negative effect. The negativity that a person produces on their body is actually doing more harm than good.
I suppose then, alongside that, there's maybe comorbidities, I think you might call it, whereas people who maybe struggle with anxiety are also people who might drink or smoke or use drugs?
Yes. So anybody who's got an underlying anxiety disorder, they're more likely to try and compensate their huge anxiety by smoking, by using drugs, by drinking alcohol to excess. And if you look at some of the deaths associated, and especially from that study, that you will find that a lot of the deaths that can be associated with anxiety disorder is suicide, because people are now linked in with, you know, they now are developing a psychiatric illness and they have just difficulty coping with it.
Mm. From a doctor's perspective again, Deirdre, like this much must push at the periphery of all the doctors who go through this, right at their skill level, because I imagine that, you know, a doctor maybe is like a detective in some respects, picking up on clues in language and how a patient is presenting and talking. But when it comes to hypochondria or illness, anxiety disorder, this is a whole nother layer where you're getting a lot of misdirection potentially. But by the same token, you have to take a patient's concern seriously on the basis that they may well be feeling the complaint as well. It sounds like really tricky stuff.
It is very tricky stuff. And a lot of the time too, David, we end up having to be in our own, I suppose, in our own minds. We need to be counsellors. We need to be psychotherapists. We need to be a bit of everything, but we need to be very importantly, very, very open to everything the patient says, because remember the boy that cried wolf, and there's always that, and that there's always that fear in any GP practice, that you just dismiss, here's that patient again, you know, who's always complaining of that. And then, you know, you just start to ignore them. You cannot do that. You've got to be very open-minded, very, very open-minded and tuned in to the possibility that something might actually be real.
Anecdotally, is this something that is presenting more often than it has done in the past, less so or the same?
I would say it is presenting more. Because guess what? We've got Dr. Google now.
Yeah.
So you've got a pain in your hip. You've got a pain in your hip now. You need a hip replacement. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you've got, as I used to say to some of my patients too, you know, when doctors get sick, doctors always get the worst thing. So if, you know, if a doctor gets a headache, they have a brain tumor, if a doctor, you know, and I'd be laughing at this, but, you know, we'd always think of, well, it could be this, it could be that. But, you just have to be so careful, and it's definitely on the increase. I have no doubt it is.
Okay, worth underlining as well, Deirdre, since you mentioned the issue there about playing with Dr. Google, is that like those algorithms are set up to produce the most provocative responses.
Yes.
So if you've got a complaint physically and you look it up, you're going to find the most dramatic potential issue before you find the most likely.
Absolutely. That's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. And hopefully, if we avoid Dr. Google and we consider the input of people like Deirdre, then we're going to maybe go through life with a bit less anxiety. But for the moment, Deirdre Ford from Kayla Medical in Athlone, thanks again for joining us on the show this evening.
No problem. You're welcome, David.
Our final guest is a parent, a coach, and a drummer in the Blizzards. You'll hear about the Mullingar Rugby Golf Classic next.
Health and fitness with the newly refurbished Midlands Park Health and Fitness Club. Refresh your fitness journey with dedicated personal trainers on hand to help you achieve your goals. Find out more at MidlandsParkHotel.com. Midlands
103. Now, we featured golf and pitch and putt very recently, actually, on health and fitness. And we've always spoken to the benefits that the sport can deliver from a health perspective. But what about, I suppose, the greater community good? It's in relation to the Mullingar Rugby Football Club Golf Classic at Mullingar Golf Club. It's set for the 3rd of May. All sold out. There's some star talent there, including former Irish rugby star Gordon Darcy, who's going to be there as an after-dinner speaker as well. But a local star as well from the Blizzards, Declan Murphy. Declan, I must ask, how's your golf game?
My golf game is reasonable now for this time of the year.
Okay.
I wasn't expecting that introduction now, to be fair, so I was caught off guard there when a local star, but I'll run with it, you know.
Good man. Tell us about the Golf Classic. It's all set for the 3rd of May. Everything's in order, is it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. We run this annually on the Friday of the bank holiday for the rugby club. Myself and my two brothers and a few other lads from the club have kind of taken her over in the last few years, and it's been hugely successful, more as a social event and also as a fundraiser for the club. And it's fully sold out, actually, in teams for next Friday. So we're delighted so far.
Events like this, you know, when you go through the organisation, people say, yeah, no, I'll be there. And they show up and then everyone enjoys the day itself. It must bring people in the club closer together.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I think a lot of people I know that I wouldn't see from one year to the next would be at the Golf Classic, you know, from my previous kind of rugby days playing. So, yeah, it really kind of brings out the all sorts of everything in terms of the rugby kind of community in Mullingar. Lads who haven't got together in a long time kind of focus on this event for a get-together and a catch-up and, you know, try and win a competition too. But that kind of comes second best, I think, in the day.
Yeah, exactly. It's for a broader cause, as it were. But naturally, everyone gets the competitive juices flowing at some point. You mentioned how long you've been playing rugby there. What's your story with rugby? What got you so involved, and has you caring about it so much?
I don't play anymore now. I coach out there at the under-15s. Mm. But just as from a young age, my father brought me out and I played all the way up to senior level and played probably for 20 years. And my two brothers are the same. They played alongside us, and just some of my best mates and still to this day are through rugby, you know. And then my young lad, Ben, who's under 15s this year, I coached him from under 9s upwards. So I brought that team all the way. And yes, like it's a huge community out there, and it's going from strength to strength, obviously. We've had a great season this year in terms of on the pitch and off the pitch. You know, there's great developments happening out in the club with the new gym, new clubhouse going in soon. So, yeah, it's just great to be a part of it. No more than any other community or kind of gathering you like that, you know, GAA club or whatever it may be. But it's great for the soul to be a part of something like that and see it progress and you know, drive on now.
You mentioned that your father brought you to rugby. So when you were bringing your son through the age grades in rugby and maybe even initially seeing him get into it, that must have been a really affecting moment, because I've got the same memories as a parent and obviously from having been a child, that these markers along the way of our lives, you realise what small things actually mean in the big picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're the kind of the cherished moments you have looking back, you know, when your son gets older and older, you have these great moments and memories that are kind of bred out of, you know, them events in terms of rugby matches or blitzes or training. And like, I don't think I'd be out there otherwise, you know. And I think the added effect for me training the Ben is I've got more and more involved in the club, and you know, and trying to progress it and be a part of its development, you know, which is also kind of a great boost for myself as well, you know. So it's my daughter Mary Kate has started now this year as well, and he loves it, like, so it's just great to be a part of, you know.
It sounds like Mullingar Rugby Club is a pretty good family scene, and it's set up with that in mind.
Oh yeah, definitely more and more now, especially when we have such a strong girls element to the club, which wasn't always there historically in the last 5 to 10 years. Like that numbers in terms of the girls side playing has probably quadrupled and doubled every year, you know. So like it's just, we're bringing in brothers and sisters now, which is great. And in my day, it was just the sons that are out there, you know. There was no opportunity for the daughters, you know. But that's there now, and there's loads of parents who have two daughters and one son playing, or the other way around, you know, which is brilliant. Like, it's just a full family event then, a full family affair, like it's the way you want it.
Yeah, and it's just a practical use of resources. If all the children can get into the same sport, it makes life probably a lot easier in that respect. The competition slots have been snapped up very quickly, but is it still the case that if businesses or individuals are looking at the likes of tea box sponsorship and dinner packages, because obviously it's going to be a busy day, that's all still available?
Yeah, that's all still available. We have 36 teams sold out, but we still have the T-Box availability, so there's a good few slots left on that. That's €100 for a tee box, and you'll see the link on our social media posts in the next couple of days as well. That will bring you directly onto it. You just pay the €100, and then we'll get the name of the company or the brand up on the tee boxes, which is brilliant. And then we also have a few slots for the after dinner slots. Gordon Darcy, who's obviously one of the most well-renowned rugby players in Ireland over the last 15 years, is doing that after dinner talk. So that would be a great, even if you're not into the golf, to come out socially at 6:30 or 7:00 and purchase the dinner and after dinner slot. Like, it'd be great support of the club as well. You don't have to be into the golf for it, you know.
Yeah.
And let's look, also we have great sponsors there, which I'd like to give a small mention to: Wines Direct, Finance Ireland, Medical Charter, Jewel, Shea Martha, and the National Science Park have been brilliant there as kind of event sponsors this year. So it's really kind of boosted us financially to go after a kind of really good after dinner speaker and make it a kind of a good rewarding financial day for the club as well, you know.
Well, I know from reading Gordon's pieces in the paper and listening to him broadcasting, he's a really interesting speaker. So that really sounds like it'd be well worth attending the after dinner event as well. Declan, you've been great with your time. We wish you the very best for the event. A big congratulations to everyone at Mullingar Rugby for the season that they have had, and the best of luck with everything going forward.
Appreciate the time, and thanks very much for giving us the slot. They're really good support for us.
We are done and dusted for another week. I really enjoyed putting that show together. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll be back next week. Joe Cooney and Country Roads is up next. I'll talk to you soon.